Welcome to the second podcast from Birmingham Fabians. My name is Corey Hazelhurst, and with me is the chair of Birmingham Fabians, Luke John Davis.
Hello.
So our second podcast, like our first podcast, is going to be about the West Midlands mayoral election. The podcast, like the contest itself, has been a little bit overshadowed by Theresa May's announcement of a snap general election.
Yeah.
We are going to do two shows about the election in the run-up to June the 8th. But what we're going to talk about today is just a quick post-mortem of the results. See how our number crunching, which we talked about on the first episode, fares up, which actually is pretty damn well. Thank you very much. And then we'll see what lessons Labour can take from this.
Isn't it horrible being right?
Any lessons apart from you should listen to us more often. A week ago, there was the West Midlands mayoral election, and Sean Simon lost very, very, very narrowly to Andy Street. It was a very, very close run thing, about 6,000 votes in it. And I think the problem with any post-mortem of a very close election result, and you see it maybe with the referendum last year, and you see it with the Clinton-Trump election in the US, you can end up almost reading too much into the result, I think, because the result is so close, it's very hard. I think we are going to be quite critical of Labour's campaign. We're probably going to be quite critical of the candidate that Labour put up. But I think what we've got to remember, maybe at the start, is actually this was very, very close, and a few votes either way could have swung it.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that you've got to consider when you have an election that's this close, right, is everybody, journalists, ourselves, think tanks, whatever, and the parties themselves look for like that one silver bullet, the one thing they could have changed or the one thing that led to the loss. And almost certainly when it's this close, it's not. Or indeed in any election, I mean, however close it is, there's always more than one factor involved. I think one of the main key things is how much you can pigeonhole the candidate into stuff that you already know. Now, what I mean by that is, you know, stuff like the Comey letter, stuff like deleted emails, stuff like taking money from Wall Street, all fed into a pre-existing perception of her as untrustworthy, which, you know, I don't think is very fair, but, you know, that was the perception. What you've got, or what you had with Andy Street, was a candidate who destroyed the preconceptions of the Conservative Party that was present in voters' minds and allowed them a clean slate to start with. And you see exactly the same thing actually with Ruth Davidson. You know, young female LGBT is not the kind of classic demographic of a Conservative, so you automatically kind of start from scratch. Andy Street did exactly the same thing.
And the thing is, Andy Street as well is just seems to be a genuinely nice person. When you see him interviewed afterwards, just seems like a nice guy. We are talking, of course, about Andy Street, former boss of John Lewis, worked himself up from the shop floor and became mayor. He's not to be confused with Andy Street, who was chair of Oxford University Conservatives. He's not that Andy Street, not the one on the John Lewis graduate programme. I don't think they're the same person. Because this Andy Street, he wasn't interested in politics until 10 months ago, was he?
Yeah, exactly. And it's not like he's, you know, in a relationship with a Conservative MP or anything along those lines. I mean, you know, but that was the perception. You know, he came across as a complete political outsider. He allowed that stain of being a Conservative, which it is in any kind of inner city or core city. He got rid of that from the start just by being the candidate he was. And then he was quite savvy in how he built on that, you know, not mentioning the word Conservative, mentioning John Lewis at all possible moments, which still has this perception of being, you know, cuddly capitalism with a you know, heart-wrenching Christmas ad every year and stuff. Conversely, I think there were potentially errors in Labour's approach.
Andy Street framed the election as being successful businessman against failed career politician.
Yeah.
And I think what you have to do is, with Labour, is try and challenge that and reframe that. And as you say, one way of doing it is by talking about the political background of Andy Street, the fact that he's not apolitical. Also, you can try and big up the fact that actually it's nice to have a politician, because I think, as I said in the first show, there are some things that politicians can do well that businessmen cannot necessarily do well.
Yeah.
But also, there was just no attempt to challenge, from Sean Simon, to challenge the narrative that was set. And I think that meant, when certainly on the doorstep, around when I was going campaigning around Bourneville, I had a lot of people saying, well, normally I'd vote Labour, but I'm voting for Andy Street because I like the way, I think that politics should be run more like a business. And when you look at what the role of the mayor is, where it's essentially a bit of a big lobbyist for big business, or is, at least that's how Andy Street presented it, you can see where that was quite attractive.
Not attending hustings and saying that he was in Brussels, being a representative in Brussels, I mean, that sort of feeds into the caricature that's being painted of him, which I think was an error. I think he could have done more to show some of the genuine stuff about him. You know, he talked about having a West Brom season ticket, but the way it came across was kind of cheesy rather than authentic.
I think maybe one of the worst things I saw was trying to campaign for all England home matches to be held in Villa Park.
Yeah.
When, I mean, for a start, we've spent the best part of £4 trillion or whatever it is on Wembley Stadium. And actually, Wembley from Solihull is all of 50 minutes on the train.
Yeah.
I don't really understand.
It was also that you know, wasn't what people were really caring about. I mean, you know, how, okay, great, England's playing at Villa Park, and how exactly does that help me buy a house or do, you know?
Are you saying that you've never had the location of England home matches as an issue on the doorstep?
I regret to say not.
Is that just because you're a member of the out-of-touch metropolitan elite? When we talked last time, we said essentially that the result was going to be very, very, very close.
Yeah.
The reason for that is, although Midlands, the West Midlands generally is a region that Labour does very, very well in, 9 out of 10 Birmingham MPs are Labour, we said that Sean Simon might be in trouble if a few following things happen. One of them is if there's a very big turnout from Solihull and not a very big turnout in some of the other areas such as Birmingham. The other thing would be, in terms of the electorate, it's going to be different to a London mayoral election. It will go down to second preferences and the winner would be decided on second preferences. Therefore, there would need to be some sort of campaign by Labour to get the second preferences of Green and Lib Dem voters.
Yeah.
And, well, lordy be, if it wasn't for the fact that Solihull, out of the 7 council areas that make up the West Midlands Combined Authority, has the highest turnout. 33% of voters turned out in Solihull to cast their ballots. 2/3 of them were for Andy Street. Now, a third might not sound like a lot, but actually it's 10% higher than it was in Sandwell. It's more, almost 10% higher than it was in Coventry. It's 8 or 9% higher than it was in Wolverhampton, Walsall. Actually, Birmingham had quite a high turnout.
Yeah, we actually did better than we expected.
28.55%.
Yeah.
Stick that in your pipe and smoke it, Coventry.
Part of that was just down to the ground campaign, I think there's certain things that need to be learnt here. Partly the issue with Sean Simon was that he wasn't... a new enough face that he could start from scratch like Andy Street did. But he also wasn't well enough known that he could play on it like Andy Burnham was.
Schrodinger's candidate, you could say.
Yeah, kind of. He kind of hit that flawed middle ground, if you like. So that was an issue.
Mm.
So with turnout, you know, we did get higher in Birmingham, not quite high enough. I haven't actually seen the breakdown ward by ward, but if it's mirroring ones that I have seen, which was Manchester, it was higher in Tory voting wards. The Labour wards that did have a higher turnout tended to be ones with a large BAME population. The other thing that we found was in the areas that don't fit either of those, the UKIP vote swung Tory.
Mm. I haven't looked at the ward by wards either for the West Midlands. Yeah, we'll try and do some analysis on that. That's probably what I'll do over the summer. I'll be on honeymoon, probably, looking at a spreadsheet of West Midlands mayoral election results.
Sarah will love that.
Absolutely. As we said last time, the way that we try to calculate the percentage of votes that the parties would get was to look at the share of the vote the parties got in each area in the 2015 election and then try and take into account the national swing.
Mm.
We used national swing from January. I suppose we should probably point out that by the time the election happened in May, the Tories were probably 2 or 3, maybe even 5 points better off than they were in January. You also had the collapse of the UKIP vote, which I think did it's one of those factors we couldn't really have foreseen, and that's why it's interesting to try and have this post-mortem discussion.
That was something we weren't sure about how the UKIP vote would play. I think we had a lot of them down on second preferences going Tory, which you know, it turned out they went Tory on the first preferences. Because of the general election being called beforehand, it turned from being a kind of local election plus to being a dress rehearsal for the general election. Now, that may have had something to do with driving up turnout in Birmingham, possibly. The main sort of thing it had on that was that people started to take, I don't want to say take it more seriously, but considered it as a higher order than perhaps you would normally class a sort of election like that, which may help in the long run. It may help people to sort of take the role more seriously and take that election more seriously. But also, I think that may have been part of the issue why UKIP swung behind the Tories. And why, you know, in places like Dudley, the Tories did much better than expected.
I think it's one of those races as well that was so close all the way through. It was always a little bit of a toss-up. It was always quite difficult to try and work out where it was going to go. One of the things that it was really hard to predict was how the calling of the general election would affect the mayoral results, because would it mean that there'd be more of a ground game from Labour campaigners to up turnout? I don't know if they're... was. I think there was probably more Labour activity, or more activity from all the other parties. Probably a lot of places wouldn't have done a full polling day, as they will do on June the 8th, where maybe they would have done on May the 4th. However, they don't want to do two full polling days in a month, because that's a lot of work. One long-term factor that meant that there wasn't as big a local get-out-the-vote operation as maybe there could have been is in Birmingham. There are local elections next year in 2018. And I think, and they are all up elections, which means that every single ward is up for grabs. And I think one thing that meant was that a lot of councillors were keeping their powder dry until 2018. And they weren't going to do a lot of campaigning now. They were going to do a lot more campaigning next year.
Possibly something in that. I mean, I'm a bit dubious about that. But I think one of the other issues actually is purely and simply burnout. Now, you know, we started the general election campaign for 2015 in about February. We then went straight from that into a leadership campaign. We then had some very nasty fallout from that for a while.
Do we? I don't remember that.
I do. I've received two death threats so far.
Now I feel bad for being flippant. if you want to send any death threat, no.
No, yeah. And then we had the Brexit referendum, and then we had another leadership election, and then we've gone from that pretty much... tiny bit of a break, but also a bit of a fallout from that, then into the Stoke by-election, then into the mayoral election, now into a general election. What we've seen is that although the membership for Labour has gone up, the activists haven't. That's puts a burden on those who are still there and still active. That's just wearing people out. We've been on a war footing now, a lot of us, for what, 2.5 years going on for, and you know, we're 2.5 years in any front line, and you're going to start getting tired, and I think that's been an issue as well.
That probably is not going to continue if we assume, let's just idly speculate for a moment, that we have a leadership election and local elections in 2018.
Well, I mean, Corbyn did call for annual leadership elections when he was a backbencher, so it looks like he's getting them.
Moving swiftly on, if we maybe roundabout go back to the UKIP vote and where that went to. I think maybe the interesting thing is that the swing wasn't necessarily uniform. So, as I say, we tried to work out, based on national swing, what we think the percentage of vote would be in the seven local authorities. Not to bore you with the figures, because it doesn't really make great listening, but in Birmingham, in Coventry, in Sandwell, in Wolverhampton, the figures are just about there.
They're within the margin kind of error.
They're in line with national swing, so they're not really that exciting. The ones which are quite interesting are Dudley, we assumed would be roughly split, about 37 points each. Actually, Andy Street took 52% of the vote there and carried that by more than 20 points. A fifth of votes in Dudley were cast for UKIP in 2015. And so I think that's one of those places where the fallout from UKIP has... quite obviously disproportionately favoured the Tories over Labour.
Yep.
The other one is Solihull. And again, in the report, we mentioned Solihull as being one of those where the Lib Dems got a disproportionate amount of votes in terms of the model anyway, because obviously they had MPs like Lauralee Burt, who got a lot of votes in the general, but you wouldn't necessarily expect them to vote Lib Dem at the mayoral level. And that seems to be borne out, because Andy Street got 2/3 of the vote in Solihull. Labour's was about what we expected, but I think a lot of Lib Dem, maybe either Lib Dem voters maybe didn't vote, didn't turn up, or maybe voted Green, because it was a Solihull, I think, is where the Greens got their highest vote. James Byrne, who are a really spirited campaign. I was a bit sorry he didn't keep his deposit, really, but he was good at the hustings I came to. And I think that might be where it was won, that actually, in terms of the Labour vote holding up, it held up pretty well.
We're actually really very close with our final prediction on what actually turned out, but I think when I sat and worked through the numbers, it was like 0.16% or something off. We were surprised, if you like, came in the area. So both in Dudley and in Walsall, the Tories got higher than we expected them to, and both in Sandwell and in Birmingham, as you say, that Labour did. Now, how that translates across to the general is going to be interesting to see. A lot of that is down to the UKIP collapse, but also I think down to the Lib Dem collapse. I think there is a presumption, which I've also discussed on podcasts before, that the Lib Dems were going to come roaring back. It doesn't seem like that's taken place.
Yeah, well, so on our sister podcast, Not Enough Champagne, you said that the Lib Dems could lose seats
yeah.
in the general. And I didn't say so at the time, out of politeness, because on that, LJ is not a co-host. LJ is a guest on our sister podcast. But I thought that, quite frankly, this was a very stupid and foolhardy thing to say. Because, I mean, the Lib Dems have only got 8 MPs. How much lower could they go? However, from what we've seen so far, I mean, potentially, you are right. I mean, we've seen on political betting that the Tories apparently targeting Tim Farron's seat.
Yeah.
One of the things that we said in the report is that maybe if there's a protest vote for the Lib Dems as a result of Remain, their vote could be much higher than we saw. And the other thing as well is that the system that was in place, the supplementary vote, it does allow you to vote for your head and your heart. And so we thought, well, obviously you've got a lot of Labour Tory marginals, the Lib Dem vote will be naturally squeezed. That doesn't seem to happen. Although I think Beverly Nielsen, again, she had a very spirited campaign. She came across quite well in hustings. Certainly better than Sean Simon did. She still didn't get very many votes.
No, and I think your issue there is the number of people who turn up to a hustings. But I think the other thing that's sort of interesting to note is that Sean Simon won second preferences by 52-48. Where have I heard that figure before? What that means is that actually, given that, as we said, that the UKIP vote went first preference Tory, is huge swathes of both Lib Dems and Greens, almost a majority, almost 50%, put Tory as their second preference.
Well, what I've heard, and I don't know if this is true, but I'm going to say it anyway, and where have we heard that before? I heard that a lot of Greens and Lib Dems second preferenced each other, which maybe also displays a bit of a lack of understanding of how the voting system works.
Yeah.
And actually a proper Labour campaign to campaign for second preferences, as we said a couple of months ago, and as we argued in the report, actually could have been really, really valuable.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, you know, there's a difference. You don't necessarily have to come outright and say, you know, the way this voting system works is kind of, all right, you've had your fun, now pick Labour or Tory, which basically is what the voting system is.
Luke John Davis pitches for the Electoral Reform Society.
The way Andy Street played it was absolutely cracking. You know, in Solihull, where the Greens are big, you were saying beforehand, he took out 4-page adverts in the local papers in green, in the font that the Greens use. It's before the 6 weeks, so they couldn't do anything about it. You know, he is out spending by the best part of £1 million that every other campaign put together.
And we haven't really mentioned the £1 million thing, but we'll...
Yeah, but yeah, we'll come on to that. But, you know, he deliberately pitched that. He talked about not building on Greenbelt. He talked about, but no extra runway at Birmingham Airport. He gave the Greens reasons to vote for him as a second preference, whereas, excuse me, we never seem to have that strategy of having stuff that activists like you and me could go on the doorstep and say. The only one that did happen, which I had a conversation with a couple of Green voters about, was a universal basic income trial. But that wasn't really flashed up. I mean, the big ones that seemed to cut through was nationalising the M6 and the runway at Birmingham Airport. Now, A, those aren't really within the purview of the Metro Mayor, and B, they're not exactly designed to appeal to the Greens' second preferences.
No, absolutely. I feel like Sean Simon was almost trying to use the mayoral election to talk about other stuff that he could try and lobby for. Mm. And so he started his campaign and started talking about policing. Well, we've got a police commissioner for that. He started talking about social care and the NHS. Well, yes, that's important, but the mayor has no power for that. And so actually, at least Andy Street talked about the stuff a mayor could do, whereas Sean Simon talked a lot about the history of the Midlands, and if I hear about that we're the place that built the Spitfire one more time.
Shakespeare, steam engines and George Eliot.
Yeah, I never ever want to hear that fact again.
Yeah, I mean, in some respects I can actually understand what he was doing, and in a lot of cases I agree with him in that you don't have the kind of pride here that people have in Manchester, which goes back to a kind of thesis of mine that actually Birmingham is a very different mindset to the other core cities of England, in that it's a craftsman's city because it was the first industrial city, it was the pioneer, rather than being the kind of industrialist mindset that dominates in sort of Manchester and Liverpool and Newcastle and places like that. Part of that is actually that if you go to places like Oldham or Bolton, they're fairly comfortable with being called Greater Manchester. If you go to Samwell or Dudley or Coventry, they're not comfortable with being called Greater Birmingham because they have their own cultures, their own history, which is part of the issue with the West Midlands Metro Mayor. You know, it's not got, you know, the way London has, the way Manchester has, the way Merseyside has, that kind of single unifying ground up feeling for the area that it covers. So I think that was, there was an issue, and I think Sean was trying to tap into something like that. But I think the issue with that is that sort of thing is something that you have to build up over a long period of time and is best done within the office itself. I don't think that's a campaigning strategy in a short, you know, the short life of a campaign.
Maybe he could have tried standing down as an MP to campaign for mayor in 2010 and then put forward that narrative. No, that wouldn't have worked, would it?
Well, you know, I mean, it's
the slogan that came out in the last couple of weeks of the campaign was building our future with the pride of our past, which kind of works. I mean, it's better than taking back control of the West Midlands, which is going to happen anyway. Even with Andy, Andy Street as mayor, he's still going to have the control that is given to him.
Yeah.
And also, it's maybe a little bit Brexity, and you're an MP, you're an MEP, you can't really own that Leave vote.
Yeah, that was, I was a bit dubious about that that slogan. We talked about whether that was done deliberately to try and will UKIP voters back, as we know that if that was the aim, it was not done,
of course, by events, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. But also, like, the second one was good, but it's like, don't change horses in midstream. I mean, you know, that came across a bit too late, I think. You know, as a lesson for the future, actually, I think that's, you know, that's something that we can do. Like, you know, we can start trying to build sort of a West Mids identity. Part of the issue with it is also West Midlands is quite a clunky technical name. It's not, you know, it seems quite arbitrary. But equally, how do you change it? I mean, you could call it the Midshires, or you could call it Mercia.
The Midshires, or various sort of, sounds a little bit Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, it does.
I mean, if you were mayor of the Midshires, yeah. I just imagine Bilbo Baggins, to be honest, in a red rosette.
Do you know what? I would be perfectly happy. Martin Freeman, if you were listening, Martin Freeman as Metro Mayor would sweep me down to the ground.
Taking back control of Middle Earth.
There's not a real kind of natural name for the area that fits, and that's, again, down to this identity thing.
We've talked about the lack of second preference strategy. We've talked about maybe turnout and the campaigns. We've talked about the fact that, I mean, bluntly, Sean Simon was the George Lazenby of candidates for this area.
That's a bit harsh.
It depends. Mark Kermode really likes On Her Majesty's Secret Service. You know,
that's true.
So, but we haven't really talked about the £1 million that Andy Street, the John Lewis boss, not to be confused with chair of the Oxford University Conservative Society. We haven't really talked about that £1 million, which is interesting because I think there was a hope in some Labour circles that, yes, he spent £1 million on all these leaflets, but because of the spending limits which are in place for the last 6 weeks of the campaign, you have to do all of it 2 months before the election. So I think there was a bit of a hope. Basically, Andy Street would just spunk £1 million on leaflets that everyone would recycle and not read before the election. Whereas actually what happened was, because people started talking about the spending and the leaflets. It's another way of getting his name into the conversation.
Mm.
And so his name just ends up being repeated. And so you hear Andy Street, the Tory candidate, has this leaflet. And so I think it was probably actually quite effective. And it's a, and they were very, very well produced. They were green and the Conservatives logo on it was nowhere. I suppose there's a couple of questions, really, which is number one, how effective were they? I mean, did effectively Andy Street buy his way into the mayoralship? Two, do we need to think about putting some spending limits in place in future mayoral elections?
If you've got £1 million to spend on getting your name out there, it is always going to be beneficial.
If you have £1 million to give to Birmingham Fabians.
Yeah, we're all ears.
We could find a use for it somehow.
It's always going to be beneficial. I don't know how much it helped. I think he was more aided by just a general air war, by just the sheer volume of the Conservative Party lead over Labour at the moment. I think it was a nice problem for him to have, you know. It's more of a way that he managed to define himself early and effectively as Andy Street, not as the Conservative candidate. And I think that did benefit him. It was also a great way of distancing himself enough from the Tories that he could pick up second preferences, as we discussed before.
And so I think, and maybe we should wrap it up here, is that actually I think for all that I have criticised Sean Simon in this episode, actually he probably was in a very difficult position. Mm. And that, coming back to what we said at the start, it was always going to be difficult when your national polls are 20 points behind, when you've got the supplementary vote system, which not many people use, so maybe parties aren't sure how to campaign, voters aren't quite sure how to use it. When you've got a very good Tory candidate spending all that money, it was always going to be hard for any Labour candidate. I still think the election was winnable. I still think we've dropped the ball. I think Andy Burnham does show that you're able to, and Sadiq Khan as well, shows that you're able to, yeah, you're able to outperform the national polls. And that actually brings us on to our next podcast we're going to do. And we're going to move slowly and segue into the general election by talking about the Birmingham seats and how we think seats in the West Midlands might fare on June 8th. Our theme tune still for this one is Plucky Good Times by Dave Depper. I'm at Twitter at Paperback Rioter.
And I'm at LJDavies87, Davies with an E. And you can also follow the Birmingham Fabians ourselves, which is at BHAM Fabians.
We are 99.84% accurate.